You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 22nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author, radical environmental activist, Derek Jensen on the myth of human supremacy. Also on the program today, it's National Renters Day of Action. Over 50 cities across the United States in 21 states taking action on behalf of people seeking housing. Also on the program today, Donald Trump proposes a nationwide stop and frisk policy at a town hall on African American concerns. Meanwhile, Bill Clinton gives us some insight into just how much Hillary Clinton doesn't support the TPP. Here's a teaser. Not as adamant against it as we might have hoped. Also, Donald Trump bought even more crap for himself with his foundation's money, and apparently is feeding his business through his political campaign. It's given me ideas, ladies and gentlemen. I've actually contemplated, like, if I run for Congress, I raise the money, and I just buy one long ad, which is me occasionally doing a podcast.
Frankly, it's a great idea.
Let me get to this. I also want to get to little bit of a retrospective on the on the debate that we had with Jimmy Dore yesterday. We got a lot of feedback on that. I doubt that you're surprised that we got a lot of feedback on that. Let me tell you though this story about Donald Trump, because it is hilarious. Except for that part that he may end up being president. But if you put that aside for a moment, this is really funny. And it's not even the part about him buying the luxury trip with the foundation money. His campaign has paid his business so far $8.2 million over the course of his campaign. He's only spent $120 million. And at this point, it's $8.2 million. And that's like sort of the low-hanging fruit in terms of determining that it's actually going to him. You know, that's not including all the, like, I'm going to pay off other people. I mean, I will cop to this. Back in the day, when I was a comedian slash filmmaker, MTV gave me $20,000 to do a short film for them. And the film, I have it somewhere, is about 3 minutes long. And it's all about how I used their money to pay off other bills I had and just videotaped it. And I felt like that would be a funny idea. So.
It is a funny idea. Well, that's the most innovative idea you've ever had.
There was a scene with me, sitting in my editor's basement when I was doing Who's the Caboose, of me paying him money to edit Who's the Caboose, money that came from the budget of the film. The DP on that shoot got paid a triple rate to shoot that film, and just coincidentally shot 3 days on Who's the Caboose for free. So you see how this works. So the 8.2 is only the money that goes directly to him. There could be a lot of other money that you're going to, like, as a bank shot to pay other bills.
I might actually pay people in these scenarios. It's amazing.
Not anybody who's actually working on the campaign.
Oh, no. I mean, let's not be ridiculous here.
Right. Somebody actually tweeted at me that Jimmy Dore was on Donald Trump's pay, was getting paid by Trump. And I said, that's highly unlikely, even if they had an agreement. But the best part is this. You can see how they're scamming here. Somebody posted online on a tweet. They had signed up to do a phone banking for Trump just to see what would happen. And or maybe it was just an email they got. To volunteer, stop by with your government-issued ID, such as a valid driver's license or passport, and sign a non-disclosure agreement to join the team. That's a weird thing to ask of volunteers. But, all right. He's a quirky guy.
The Bernie Sanders campaign didn't ask me anything like that.
Really? That is shocking. But here's the best part. Your introduction is at Trump Tower, 725 Fifth Avenue, New York City. Okay? So you got to get down to Fifth Avenue, New York City. Please go to the garden level of the Trump Tower and check in with security. You must provide security with a special password, Trump Train. That's all right. The password is valid from Thursday, September 22nd through Sunday, September 25th. So it's this weekend. And are you ready for this? You ready for when they are doing, on Thursday and Friday, and then on Saturday and Sunday, when they're doing the phone banking? From 12 to 5 p.m. So in other words, at a time where people are at work, so people who can barely come down to volunteer because they're at work, theoretically, right? And 12 to 5 on the weekends is probably the last time that anybody's in their home. Or even during the weekday. Like, right? Like you do the mornings on the weekends and then the late afternoon when people come back from their day. So they're renting out office space at Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue, New York City. Presumably for all these volunteers to come at a time like where it's virtually impossible for them to do it. And I can guarantee you this is the most expensive 4-day rental that you could ever imagine. Also, to simplify your training, bring your own laptop, tablet, device, and a charger. We have limited number of spares, I bet.
Trump Train.
There you go. We're on the Trump Train.
The thing of majesty.
Choo choo. Or I should say, ka-ching, ka-ching. All right, I will recap some of the stuff from yesterday. But a lot of people emailed me and tweeted at me, hey, here's stories about how the filibuster is already gone. Because a big part of Jimmy's plan to take back the country is that the Democrats would be able to filibuster for 2 years, at least one, if not multiple, Supreme Court seats for those 2 years. I guess presumably a little longer than 2 years, right? Because it would have to go from January to January. And then they would take back the Senate 2 years later after filibustering for 2 years. A lot of people say, well, Jimmy doesn't seem to understand that the filibuster is gone. Now, that is the case for all federal judge positions. So I'm assuming Jimmy doesn't care about the D.C. Circuit Court, which rules on all whether or not, like, the EPA has regulatory authority, et cetera, et cetera. For legislation and for the Supreme Court, the filibuster is still in place. However, folks like Hugh Hewitt, who've interviewed Mitch McConnell, have said more or less that they expect Mitch McConnell to nuke that in the event that there is a Republican president. So it is more likely than not. It is, I think, objectively speaking, we can all agree it is more likely that Mitch McConnell will get rid of the filibuster for SCOTUS nominations than the moon will fall into Lake Michigan. Can we all agree on that? Okay. I mean, I say that only because that seems to be a big part of the plan. And then I would also say I got an email from somebody who said, Good show yesterday with Jimmy Dore. Sorry, Sam, I think Jimmy's point is correct. The incredible thing is both of you are arguing the tactics of this fall is that the barn doors are open, horses are gone, and the barn is in ashes. So, in other words, country, we've already lost the country. You're both arguing about the ashes. Jimmy's right. The whole system is corrupt and a reboot is needed. Okay. I know you're a little squeamish about revolution. Who isn't? Now, I did not get the revolutionary part of Jimmy's plan. Jimmy's plan was to allow the Republicans to control government for 2 years. Democrats do their best to create a holding pattern. Out of this will emerge the best Democrat possible, Elizabeth Warren, who would be the oldest presidential candidate in the history of presidential candidates, I think. Maybe just about a little bit older than Bernie Sanders is today, I believe. And she will win the presidency. And I'm not clear what's going to happen with Congress and the Senate. We're all the Uber Democrats. But that's not a revolution. That's just we're going to get a better Democrat. That's not a revolution. So it's not that I'm squeamish about revolution, although I probably am, until you fill out the details of exactly what's going to happen.
Are there locks? Yeah, you are.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like...
What about Zabars?
Are we going to lose Zabars in the revolution? Look, send me the details of the revolution, then I'll tell you whether I'm squeamish. But I don't think what Jimmy is calling for, or at least as far as I can understand his plan, is for a revolution. It's just for Democrats to take control of the presidency and the Senate. And a Democrat that he likes better. So... All right. With that said, we're going to talk to someone who I think based upon we've interviewed him in the past once before and based upon his writings, I think is very revolutionary. And I think even beyond where our politics or what we contemplate as our normal politics are. When we come back, we'll be talking to Derek Jensen, author of The Myth of Human Supremacy. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program author of multiple books, including Endgame, The Culture of Make-Believe, co-author of Deep Green Resistance, and his most recent, The Myth of Human Supremacy, Derek Jensen. Derek, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with, I guess, how I sort of teased this segment that You are, I mean, I think, is it fair to say that you're a radical environmentalist?
Sure, especially if we use the word radical in its root way, which is radical means go to the root. Like the square root of 4 would be the radical of 4 in math. And maybe I used that wrong. But in any case, radical just means going to the root of something.
And so tell us about the idea of human supremacy, or I should say the myth of human supremacy.
Well, how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And so many indigenous people have said to me that the primary difference between Western and indigenous ways of looking at the world is even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. And most Westerners perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And given that this culture is the behavior, collective behavior of members of this culture is killing the planet, it would be time for us to examine some of our basic premises. And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. Another line is just pretty much the same way, is there was an article, I live on the coast in California, and there was an article in the newspaper a couple of years ago about why the crabbers work so hard during the season. And they said, imagine that there's all these envelopes filled with $1.50 each, which is how much they get paid for every crab. Imagine there's all these envelopes filled with $1.50 each, and they're just scattered all over the ground. You'd run around as fast as you can, pick them up. And that's true, insofar as it goes, except that crabs actually aren't envelopes full of $1.50. That doesn't mean you can't eat crabs, and it doesn't mean that crabs don't die, none of that stuff. But what it means is that if you perceive them as resources to be exploited, that's what you're going to do. And so with this book, one of the things that I've attempted to do is to look at, well, I'm going to go a different direction for a second, which is, there's a great line that I read in my 20s by a guy by the name of Robert Coombs, I believe, which is, unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture. And those are the things we don't even think about. We just accept as completely given. And this idea that humans are fundamentally superior to everybody else and separate from everybody else is one of those unquestioned beliefs. So I wanted to go through the book. I wanted to go through a lot of the rationales that we use for maintaining this superiority. Because I want to bring in one more thing before I stop this, which is that there's a great line by Robert J. Lifton about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is not an atrocity, but instead actually a good thing. So from their own perspective, the Nazis weren't, in fact, committing genocide. They were purifying the Aryan race. And the Americans have never committed genocide. Instead, they were manifesting their destiny. And another way to say all this is that nobody is ever a jerk. You know, we always have our behavior fully rationalized. They had chattel slavery was fully rationalized through religious means, through scientific means. There was one study that they did in the 1830s that said that the distance between the African male's penis and his belly button is greater than it is for white people, and therefore it's okay to enslave them. I mean, of course, in retrospect, it's complete nonsense. But at the time, this was actually thrown forward as an argument. And so what I wanted to do is try to dismantle some of the arguments that we use to pretend that we're superior to everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about some of those arguments. But before we do, let's talk about the arguments first. I mean, because, I mean, this is, I mean, the this phenomena is not just a Western one, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that I don't know. Is it a modern one? I mean, because it's, we look to Asia and to the East. I would imagine it's also there. I mean, it seems to be one of, define, or give me a sense of who embodies this and who doesn't. I think the idea that there are indigenous people who do not, at least to the extent that I'm aware of, that have a different relationship with the planet and other things. But is this a temporal phenomenon? I mean, is it something that we developed, or is it something that is at least always been a strain within humanity?
I think that it's not. I think that obviously because some humans manifest it, it is latent in humans, and there are other humans who don't manifest it so much, which means that also is latent in humans. And our social stories that we're told can help reinforce these supremacisms. And really what the book's getting at is that it has to do with a worldview that is based on the notion that life is all a hierarchy, as opposed to not a hierarchy, but there are certainly artificially imposed hierarchies. I'm not saying that. But that naturally, one of the most pernicious and harmful notions that have ever been created is what's called the Great Chain of Being, which said that God is way up here, and then there's angels, and then there's the king, and then after that there's the royals, and then the rich people, and by the way, men, and then women come below that, and then what they called primitives below that, and then animals, and then plants, and then rocks, etc. And this was a hierarchy of perfection based on those at the top are more, are less embodied. It's based on the notion of mind being over body, that the animals, that's why we can enslave them, is because they don't have minds, according to the idea. And what I'm really getting at is that we even think about this, we think of the king of the jungle, we think of the top of the food chain, but even something like the top of the food chain, there is no such thing as a top of a food chain, because ultimately, if the polar bear is at the top of the food chain, ultimately worms eat the polar bear. You know, right. It comes back around. It's another way to look at all this is cycles and sort of to look at it orchestrally, that the purpose of being a violinist in an orchestra is not to kill all the oboe players and take their seats, but the purpose of a violin player is to play your proper role at the proper time. And this doesn't mean that everybody's always friendly. I've loved this line that Winona LaDuke said years and years ago about how the Anishinaabe considered the Dakota their honored enemy. And the point on that is that they didn't like each other, and I have a friend who is Dakota who to this day does not like the Anishinaabe, and that has to do with issues the conflicts that go back a long time. But they can't imagine the universe without them. And that's a difference than trying to wipe them out and steal everything that's theirs. Do you see what I'm trying to get at with this?
Yeah, yeah. That concept makes sense to me. And I think what I'm asking is where does that hierarchy, where does that come from? It's clear to me that in the context of the example that you use, you know, we have God, which is this like just brain orb essentially that floats up there and has no body, and therefore it's already sort of setting the ground rules of, you know, how we perceive this meritocracy, right? The brain floating orb is the highest value, and to the extent that we share that, and let's say animals don't, or trees don't, or, you know, rocks don't, or whatever it is, then we're that much closer to the highest level of that hierarchy. And to a certain extent, that's one that I understand, because there's a sort of a Judeo-Christian, element to it. But What of other cultures? Like, you know, where does this, how is it that this thing is latent in some humans and not others? Like, what is it, or do you have a sense, I guess, of what has made it manifest? I mean, is it, I mean, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I think that it's latent in all of us, but once again, social stories can reinforce. I think that one of the interesting things and one of the ultimately sad things about, or tragic, I don't want to use that word either, I'll just say what it is, which is that we are deeply influenced by the stories that we tell. I love this line by Daniel Quinn about how if, you know, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with humans. We're not like a plague species. But if you give us a story to live by that tells us that we are embedded in a symphony and it is your role to figure out what your role in life, to figure out what role you're supposed to play in life, then that's how humans will live. But if you tell them the story that they should go forth and multiply and that all the creatures of the earth should fear them, then they will declare war on the earth and will leave the earth a bloody wreck. And so part of it has to do with stories that we have been telling ourselves for a long time, such as that trees don't communicate. And in the book, there's a fair amount of research I show, you know, by various people looking into this, that plants communicate quite extensively. And I've seen this in my own life, that I had a tree once that just got this infestation of aphids, and I didn't know what to do, and so I just watched it. And after a couple weeks of the trees dropping leaves and everything else, I start seeing these little golden black little worm-type things, and I didn't know what they were at the time. It ends up they're ladybug larvae. So what the tree had done is when it started getting chewed on, it sent out messages saying, help, help, I need something here. Or maybe it sent out messages saying, hey, buffet. And before you know it, there were just thousands of ladybug larvae on the tree. And this is happening all the time, that one tree will get chewed on and another tree, and it will send out messages to other trees around saying, hey, change the composition of your leaves because there are caterpillars who are eating us. And so there was in the book, there's a place where some scientists doing some of that research said something that was just extraordinary to me, that gets to the heart of some of this at least, which is they're seeing that the trees are sending out messages through sending out pheromones to other plants to pick up. And the question they ask is, why would one plant clue in its competitors that there's a threat? Why wouldn't it just, you know, maintain silence, change the composition of its own leaves, and then not spend energy cluing in its competitors that something bad's happening, because you'd think a wampum wipe them out. And I thought about this, and I was like, they do this because they understand that they live in a community. Let's change one word. Why would the plant tell its neighbors that there is a threat? And that's really what it gets at, is this notion that life is a competition, where life is like a game of Risk or Monopoly, where the point is to run the board and to end up taking over everything. That's sort of the core, part of the core perspective that is really destructive, as opposed to the point of life is to figure out your role and to live in a place more or less forever, and to actually improve the capacity of the land to support you. I mean, salmon do that. Salmon improve the health of the forest by being there, and meanwhile, the forest is improving the health of the salmon by doing what they do. And then humans living within that forest can help the forest too by eating the salmon and pooping it out through the forest, delivering the nutrients. And so really, in some ways, the core of the book is that I think that one of our central thought errors is this notion that everything is based on atomized individuals. I'm going against the long version of the neoliberal model, that what I'm saying is that life does not consist of all these monads running around competing with each other and trying to destroy each other and trying to capture each other, But life really consists, as I said earlier, of this sort of symphony where our job is to try to figure out how to, okay, I'm going to put it another way. We always hear that natural selection is based on strict competition. You know, this is sort of the selfish gene model, that strict competition, everybody just doing what they can to exploit everybody else. But here's the thing. Those creatures who survived in the long run have survived in the long run. And the way you survive in the long run is not by hyper-exploiting your surroundings and ultimately harming your surroundings. The way you survive in the long run is by actually improving the capacity of the land to support you, by actually improving your habitat. And there are human models for this. The Talo, I live on Talua Indian land here, and I'm not valorizing them. I'm not putting them forward as they never had any problems. Of course, they squabbled. Of course, they did all sorts of things. But that doesn't alter the fact that it's undeniable that they lived here for 12,500 years at least. You can't deny that unless you just don't want to believe carbon dating. So they lived here for at least 12,000 years, and they didn't trash the place. When the first Westerners arrived here, the place was just a salmon paradise. And now, of course, the salmon are in deep, deep trouble. And so I would think that as we see the world unraveling around us, I would hope that we would start asking some fundamental questions about how is it that we're looking at the world that's causing us to behave in ways that are having such dramatic consequences.
But isn't there also perhaps a somewhere in between that on that evolutionary model where it is that it that not only is it that those entities that contribute to the health of everyone else around them, to the success around them, right? It's not just that is evolutionary beneficial, evolution, it's evolutionarily beneficial to do that, right? To be conscious and to help others survive around you rather than to be in competition with them. But I mean, to a certain extent, you know, we're just seeing the species that are still here, right? I mean, how would we know that there hadn't been an elimination of other species that just simply weren't competing in that way? Or is this could one look at that as like the successful way to compete to the extent that it, or to survive is simply to, I guess that's maybe the argument, is that the successful way to thrive and to continue is to ensure the success of others around you.
Well, I think the real argument is that any model I suggest and any model you suggest is just a model, and the real world is infinitely more complex than either model we would put forward.
Right.
So the real thing is to approach the world with humility and to approach the world with, wow, this forest is incredibly complex, and if I remove banana slugs, I don't know what's going to happen. And to approach it with a precautionary principle, which is just that you don't make a major change unless the burden of proof is on the idea that there will be no harm done by this intervention. And, I mean, I live around bears. I see bears all the time. I see bears literally every day. And there's a mother with a couple of babies who comes around all the time right now. And I'm noticing something that I've noticed in many generations before. If they have twins, quite often, one of the twins is pretty aggressive and will always run forward and push the other one away from whatever they're eating, or will, if the mother sends them up a tree, one of them, it's always one of them, will come down much sooner. The other one's very timid. And since I've seen this so much, I've thought, wow, that's interesting that the one who pushes the other away from food obviously gets more food, but then it's a really good survival strategy, because on the other hand, the one who's also more aggressive, if it comes out at the wrong time, if it's a black bear, and if grizzly bears were still here, if it came out to sort of explore when there's a grizzly bear there, it could die. So it's really smart on the part of the bears, and I'm not saying that they consciously decide to have one who's aggressive and one who's timid. What I'm saying is that there is great intelligence in nature, and there was great intelligence. I have a friend who says this. There's great intelligence in time and in the evolution over thousands and thousands of years of this particular survival strategy. And so what I'm saying is that, sure, there are times that these two babies are competing, but there is a time to compete and a time to not compete, a time to be aggressive, a time to be timid. And there are times when either one will work. So what I'm saying is that we have this idea that humans are supposed to, that a lot of people will accept. They'll just say, wow, a measure of biological success is how many of us there are. And it's like, okay, let's think about that. And that's really just the colonial model applied to the real world.
Right.
But that's not a model of biological success. My model of biological success would be, how long have you lived there and did you destroy the place? And so what I'm asking is that, I'm not saying that
I mean,
evolution
we should say
is
that
only based on, go ahead,
a biological success. I mean, we don't necessarily have the time frame to make that assessment yet, right? I mean, every system has an equilibrium, and we wouldn't necessarily be aware of the fact if we have created, I mean, I think your argument is we have created a disequilibrium, but we haven't necessarily, we don't know what the time frame is to measure biological success in terms of reproduction.
We know that the huge reproduction that's happened over the last 5,000 years is just, to use a cliche, you know, it's just a blink of an eye in evolutionary time. That's not, but we can see that there has been great harm caused by this notion that the world is the enemy, and that we need to go forth and conquer, and that we have the right to do that. And so really, once again, what this book is attempting to do is to look through a lot of the ways that we perceive ourselves as superior and sort of shoot them down. There are fish who use tools, if you want to use that, you know, if tool making is what you're going to choose. There are fish who use tools. Here's another part, is when we think of wonderful pieces of art, this sort of gets to the core of it. We think that humans are the only ones who create. When we think of wonderful pieces of art, we, including myself, would think of, you know, the Mona Lisa or, you know, Sistine Chapel or Rembrandt or, you know, whatever. And why can't we think of the colors of trees and falls? Why do we not consider that art? When we think of singing, why do we think of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, but we don't necessarily think of frog singing as art? Somehow they don't create. Or like, who developed penicillin? Or who discovered penicillin? We always think that that's Fleming. And why don't we say that the actual fungus, the mold, actually invented penicillin? When they created, it doesn't count. When we created it, it does count. And so when you look at the world in terms of them creating, and say, well, they just created it through their bodies. Bingo, we're right back to that great chain of being where if it's created with a body, it doesn't count. So this is one reason that scientists get so excited about maybe creating some life in a lab, when like every bunny is creating life out there right now, and humans are creating life too. But somehow when it's created naturally, that doesn't count. And that's that sort of contempt for the natural processes is really, really destructive and scary.
I mean,
I'm not saying we shouldn't create anything at all.
No.
I'm not saying that with our minds. What I'm saying is we should recognize that that's one form of creation, and there are other forms, too, that are not less valid and not less important.
I mean, isn't it, and I guess, you know, I mean, I get a part of this is tied into sort of that my earlier question about, you know, so how did we develop this, narcissism or sense of supremacy? But isn't it, I mean, isn't there also a, I mean, I don't know that I believe this, but as sort of the devil's advocate, I mean, the idea that, well, maybe this is just the way that it's supposed to be, that we're just, you know, I mean, there are, I think natural a change like that maybe the planet isn't necessarily built to be sustainable. I'm just saying, you know, I mean, obviously I have a vested interest in the sustainability of the planet, but you know, maybe everything dies. And we are just sort of the metaphorical old age, that wears it out or creates that, you know, the star that, implodes. I mean, maybe we're just that agent.
Okay. A couple of things on that. The first one is, let's pretend that that story is true. That is certainly a different story than the story that we are the greatest creature ever to exist on the planet, and we are just, we are the universe knowing itself, right, which is, so first off, that's a really different story. Basically, we are the scourge. We are the, I mean, that's, that's.
I'm not judging me that, I'm not judging us that harshly. I'm just saying, like, you know, that's what happens.
Okay, well, so first off, that's still a different story than thinking that we're the greatest thing that ever happened.
Right.
Okay, and second, let's put this in terms of something personal. That let's say that you are in a house, and all your friends and your family are in the house, and there is an axe murderer comes into the house and starts pulling people out of the room one by a time and killing them. And are we all, those of us still in the room, are we going to go, wow, so I guess it's time. I guess this is just the age of destruction. And so this is something I hear quite often. It's like, well, oh, well, this is what happens. And I always think, let's make it personal. Let's bring it back because this is really happening. And I can't think of a worse legacy than, I mean, there are solid scientists who are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish in 35 years.
Right.
And I just wrote an essay not very long ago about our 10 greatest accomplishments having to do with water. And by greatest accomplishments, I was turning the whole thing on its head. And if you ask people 5,000 years ago, do you think that people could actually kill the oceans? They would go, ah, nice joke, buddy. They'll put somebody on the moon, but they're not going to kill the oceans. And so I
feel like if you asked that 200 years ago, you'd get the same answer.
Oh, absolutely. 1870, they did, they were concerned because the oceans were being overfished at the time. And people have done calculations since 1870 that if you weighed all the fish in the oceans in 1870 and you weighed them again in 2010, they would weigh 10% of what they weighed in 1870.
Wow.
You know, the accounts of the fecundity of the world prior to, I mean, there are all sorts of contemporary accounts from the 1870s, from the 1770s. There were so many cod in the North Banks that they would actually slow down the passage of ships. Ships would get stuck in cod, you know? And this is not just making this up. These are all sorts of contemporary accounts. And so the point is that this is really happening. And once again, I would hope that we would ask ourselves why. And one of the questions you've asked, which I've sort of avoided a couple times, but is really important, is where did this start? And one of the things that's really crucial to this is that once you have what agriculture itself is, agriculture has been called by many people the worst mistake humans have ever made. And what it does is it converts the entire land base to the entire piece of land to human use, and then allows you to increase human population because of that. But the problem is, couple problems, but the main problem is that once you've started yourself on that path, you've committed yourself because you've harmed the land to increase the number of humans. Now you've got this many humans here. What are you going to do? You have a choice. You can either collapse or you can expand. And so for the last 5,000 years, any culture that has been gone down the road of agriculture, they've then had to go down the road of conquest because they destroyed the Tigris and Euphrates. That was the cradle of civilization, and it was the Fertile Crescent. I don't think anybody would call it the Fertile Crescent anymore. I've seen some extraordinary documentaries about the war in Iraq, the most recent invasions, and one of the things that impresses me the most is that you can look sometimes from horizon to horizon, not see a single plant. And that was cedar forest, so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. Mm. And so then, as you see this expand outward, it creates this this terrible, terrible dilemma. What are we going to do? Because we are harming the land in order to maintain our both population and militarism, and then you keep expanding because you don't want to collapse. And the other thing it does that's really, really harmful is that as soon as – okay, so I've talked about these bears, and the bears are – bears get into things. And in the last 2 weeks, I've had three tires on my truck get bitten by bears and flattened, and so I had to replace them. That annoyed me. And on the other hand, the bears will break trees sometimes, and – they just break trees. They're not my trees. It's like, whatever, that's what bears do. But they came into my mom's garden, and they broke her sumac, and my mom got really mad. And my point is that once you put yourself into a position of this is – there's a difference between the Talua eating salmon, which are the salmon's own being. They're not my salmon. And there's a difference between when you get into agriculture, one of the things you do is you make all these plants and animals dependent upon you. So there's a deer who runs by, the deer takes care of itself. If the deer gets eaten by a mountain lion, you don't care. But if that's my cow, I sure care. And so one of the things it does is it starts to create a mindset where it's not that the salmon created the food, it's not that the forest created the food, but I created the food because I planted the wheat, I plowed the field before I planted the wheat, I did all the work, I weeded everything, and I made sure that there were no pests in here, I killed everybody who came near it. And so you start to have functionally, experientially, an entirely different experience of the world where you are, I'm having to work to create this, it's mine, and if somebody comes in to get it, I'm going to kill them. And that's an entirely different attitude than all these other beings that, you know, I'll kill the ones I eat, but other than that, I didn't make them. Do you see what I'm trying to get at with that?
Yes. I mean, that's where the hierarchy, I don't know if that's where it starts, but it certainly
enhances it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't know if it's, you know, quote, started there either. That's a question. I don't know origins, but that certainly exacerbates. There are a lot of people who think that agriculture is the hierarchical model for is where it started for the notion that men are superior to women, the notion that we are superior to some people think that it's the model for all the other supremacisms. I don't know that I agree with that, but I do think it's something to think about. In any case, finally answering your question about where did it start, that's where I think a lot of it started, was with the notion of agriculture.
All right, so if it's the case, I mean, how do we if people were to read the myth of human supremacy and have this revelation, but what would we do at this point in terms of, would it be to create, I mean, we're on that agriculture train at this point. Like you say, it is very difficult to get off. I mean, maybe now we have the technology to get off that train. If everything went well and people read the book, what would happen?
I love what a doctor friend of mine says, that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And any solutions to our current situation that emerge from a human supremacist mindset are not going to, only by accident could they actually help the world, because their primary goal is still going to be to attempt to maintain this human supremacist position. So what I would want is for people to switch their loyalty from this human supremacist system to the natural world. And one of the things I hammer in the book quite extensively is this notion that we can manage the natural world. We think people keep saying, there is not a single biome in the entire planet that has not been harmed by management when it's been done by human supremacists. But having said all that, I want to say that the local Forest Service where I live is actually quite good. And I've been an opponent of the Forest Service everywhere, but it's actually quite good here. And one of the reasons it's really good is because there's no timber sale program in the local Forest Service. So they're not actually extracting resources. What they're doing is attempting to fix harm by taking out old logging roads and taking out old mining roads and making sure these roads don't slump into creeks. And so the first thing I would want us to do, so many indigenous people have said to me that the most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds, by which they mean we have to change our loyalty from this system that's not serving us well over to the real world. And every cell in my body wants for us to use our cleverness and our inventiveness and our intelligence, such as it is, to try to fix some of the problems that we've made instead of make more problems. And so what I would want for people to do is to, once you look at the world with this new respect, I would love for us to start trying to solve some of the problems we've created. Okay, here's part of the problem, is that capitalism, we all recognize, is a pyramid scheme, or many of us recognize it's a pyramid scheme, and it requires constant new consumers. And so it's very interesting to see some people, the same people sometimes talk about how, oh, humans are overpopulating, but then when they learn that rich white consumers are not having enough children, according to them, you know, they will say, oh my God, we have to, like, what is it, Japan has baby days where now everybody's supposed to try to make a baby, and Russia has given people.
Oh, Derek, you there?
They're decrying, you know, the fact that there are a lot of brown people. And so my point is that we have to resolve that dilemma, too. We have to recognize, look, capitalism requires this constant expansion. You can't have constant expansion on a finite planet. Because we could solve the whole overpopulation question problem really easily if there weren't these other cultural barriers. It's very simple. About half of the children born right now are not actually wanted. So the solution to overpopulation, if we didn't have to worry about capitalism being a pyramid scheme, is we could, and if we didn't have to worry about patriarchy and men controlling women, is give women absolute reproductive freedom. Bingo. Overpopulation problem solved, because the children that they don't actually want would not be had, would not be born. And the children who want, the parents want to be born, the mothers want to be born, would be born. So that's sort of a rational solution that you see immediately where we fall into this morass of cultural impediments to having what would be a reasonable solution. And I would love to see, oh, here's another example, is right now, you know, the worlds are being, the oceans are just being vacuumed as well as everything else. And right now, the world's commercial fishing fleets are being subsidized by governments to a value greater than the actual catch. So we would all be better off if they would just give these fisher people, if they would just give them money and tell them to stay home in their underpants and watch The Price is Right, you know, that would actually be better for all of us. And, you know, what's in many types of fishing, 70 to 80% of the, like shrimping especially, 70 to 80% of the fish are just tossed back overboard dead because they're not the target fish. And so my point is, I would love to see us start with simple solutions like that, where we start acting, where we start taking seriously these problems, and we start gliding towards some sort of soft descent and sort of soft landing, because getting this way of life can't last. And I would love for us to see a voluntary transformation. I don't believe that's going to happen, but it's certainly not going to happen if we don't actually talk about the issues. So that's what I want, is I want for us to look at how we perceive the world, what we think are the goals of life, a small subject there, and how we, I mean, this notion that everything is based on competition affects everything. I'm going to use a really big word here, epistemology. And all epistemology means is how we know something is true. And there's a great line by Richard Dawkins, which is, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And that's really true, because we know that science works because I lean over here and I hit the light and the lights go on or off. And we made a matter and energy jump through hoops on command and we predict what will happen and when. And that's how we know it's all true. But it's really sneaky, because what he's done is he has also conflated domination with actually how we know something's true. That we are making matter and energy jump through hoops on command, as okay, let's say you and I are in a room, and let's say there's a hoop in the room, and let's say there's a gun in the room, and I have the gun. And I hold the hoop up, and I point the gun at you, and I say, look, on the count of three, you're going to jump through the hoop. On the count of three, you jump through the hoop, because if you don't, I'm going to shoot you. And so that's all great. What I just did is I made matter and energy jump through hoops on command, and I predicted what would happen and when. The problem is, don't you think it's also possible that by putting a gun on you and by telling you to jump through a hoop, that I have also destroyed any possibility of other relationships, destroyed the possibility of friendship? And my point in bringing all that up is that this is how deeply this notion that we are, that the idea is to dominate others, that's how deeply that notion infects us. It affects our very epistemology, how we know things are true. And all I'm saying with this book is there are also a lot of other ways to know that are true that don't. This way of knowledge has consequences, and other ways of knowledge have different consequences. And so I would hope, with all the world at stake, we would start looking at some of these unquestioned assumptions. Are we really smarter than a bear? How do we determine intelligence? Is it even meaningful to make cross-species intelligence comparisons? Because all the comparisons that are put forward to say, oh, we're smarter than chimpanzees, we're smarter than salmon, they're all based on a projection of our version of intelligence onto
right.
them.
Right.
We've they created can't be intelligent the intelligent in their own way.
Right. We've created the meritocracy, and it just so happens we sit atop it. And
what do you know? Isn't that a coincidence?
Yes, that's always it's always nice when that works out that way. Derek Jensen, thank you so much for your time today. The book is The Myth of Human Supremacy. Folks can go to derekjensen.org. We'll link to it at majority.fm. Fascinating stuff. I really appreciate the time today.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for asking.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half, wherein we will play some sound from Donald Trump's supremacy tour. It's fascinating stuff. And I think that there's, both obviously we have an ecological and environmental crisis that we're facing. Today the Icelandic sheets are melting at a faster rate. That's all. You never see that story where it's like, well, they're melting actually much slower than we anticipated. But also, I think concepts which have application in other areas. So that's derekjensen.org. Let's link to his site for that book. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. Remember, you can become a member of this program. There's a couple of people who said goodbye yesterday to us. Fair enough. But there were more of you who sent nice emails. So, but it is true. There was somebody who was telling me, like, you won't have a show if you keep losing. You've lost hundreds of your audience. I don't know how that person knows that. Hundreds is not necessarily that many relative to our audience. But it made me contemplate the idea of, like, I would have the show. I could just sit in my closet and record it. Nobody would hear it. But nevertheless, that's enough philosophy for today. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also support this program by buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. If you buy your crap from Amazon or from Jet.com, do so at MajorityReportKickback.com. And always, you can check out the support the sponsors page. And subscribe to YouTube. We're trying to get to 100,000 subscribers on YouTube. And we're close. Super close. Apparently, what happens is we get the play button turns a different color. It's pretty exciting. So help us out. All right. We'll be back in a minute.